From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Communication between people who speak different languages is an age-old challenge. Today, computer programs can translate words instantly. But what about conversations that need translation? Intense conversations where life or death could hang in the balance. Well, police, paramedics, and other first responders increasingly encounter that kind of situation. And as Minnesota Public Radio's Conrad Wilson reports, there is new technology aimed at instantly bridging the language gap.
A paramedic arrives at this scene. A screaming baby is badly burned, but the mother doesn't speak English, and the medical staff can't communicate with her.
Good evening. Hi, I have a lady that speaks Arabic. We need to get some information on her baby. Okay. Ask her what exactly happened. What was the baby burned with?
It turns out the baby was burned in a cooking accident.
Okay, just let her know that I have a doctor that's with us right now. The gentleman in the gray shirt is a doctor, and we're going to be transporting her and the baby to Children's Hospital. Let her know that.
Okay.
That conversation was possible because of a device called ELSA, enabling language service anywhere. Using a cell phone signal, the handheld device gives users access to interpreters in about a minute who can translate between English and 180 other languages. The interpreters themselves work for a company called Language Line Solutions, but the ELSA device is made by a Minnesota-based company created by this guy.
I'm Charles Howerton, the founder and VP of New Business Development for RTT Mobile.
Howerton came up with the idea 6 years ago after he struggled to communicate with Spanish-speaking workers at his construction company.
I was able to build my first prototype, and it had wires hanging out of it and a radio board hanging out of it. Pretty rough looking, but it actually worked very well.
Since then, the device has become more sophisticated. Roughly the size of an old school cell phone, it has three buttons, built-in microphones, and a speaker.
Calling one.
Pushing a button once brings up a Spanish translator.
Thank you for calling RTT Mobile Interpretation. Please hold while I get connected with your Spanish interpreter.
About 30 seconds later, the interpreter is ready to translate from English to Spanish and from Spanish back to English.
Hi, this is Francine. I will be your Spanish interpreter. How can I help you?
The ELSA translation tool was released in December. Howerton says it's already in use around the country.
First responders, medical, police, fire, they're the ones that need to communicate the most.
Law enforcement officers in St. Cloud, Minnesota recently started using the ELSA translation device. Sergeant Jason Burke works in the training unit at the St. Cloud Police Department and says he relied on bilingual officers and other translation services that require scheduling an appointment.
The difference is the immediacy of getting access to an interpreter.
Burke says the new device fills that need. He says it was recently used when police and paramedics needed to deliver a baby, as well as during a domestic violence call.
As years go on, in whatever community that you're in, you can see a lot more non-English speaking people moving into the community. It has been difficult in the past to be able to communicate with some people when you have contact with them through law enforcement.
Burke says the main drawback is cost. The department has just a few for its entire patrol unit, and at $400 apiece and up to $2 per minute to operate, a complicated police call can quickly become expensive. Still, it appears those costs aren't slowing down business. According to the company, use of the ELSA device is growing, some months doubling in use. Now Howerton says RTT Mobile is preparing to bring the device to the general public through a Kickstarter project this summer. Howerton says the funds will help pay for the next generation of the device that will make translation easier for everyone, not just first responders.
Like me, like I ran into on the construction site, you know, many times I wasn't able to communicate with people that I needed to. It was just a lot of grief and headache and very time-consuming.
This part of the technology industry is full of innovation. Last year, Microsoft unveiled a vocal translation program, but by the company's own admission, there are still errors. Not something you want in a first responder situation. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson.
Let's hear another installment of the NPR Cities Project.
If other cities can do it, we can do it.
This whole building is based on technology.
This is an old city, but we are on the latest technologies.
Okay, the NPR Cities Project is our exploration of urban innovation, using technology to become more efficient or try to be safer. Today we'll focus on surveillance cameras and sophisticated software that goes with them. They become big business, oldest cities of all sizes. NPR's Stephen Henn reports from a suburb of Sacramento, California called Elk Grove.
I'm sitting on a swing in Miwok Park in Elk Grove, California. The morning commute here is made up of toddlers, kids, dog walkers, some moms. But right now, I'm being watched almost as carefully as I would be if I were on Wall Street. There's a camera right over my head.
I didn't even know that one was there.
Chelsea Yoakum is playing with her son. Nearby, a couple is lying on a picnic blanket, kind of snuggling.
We were just kind of enjoying each other's company, I guess you can say.
They know there's a camera here, but do you know where that camera feed goes or what happens to it?
No, I have no idea.
It goes directly into the Elk Grove Police Department.
That is kind of scary in a sense, just knowing that people are watching no matter what.
That man didn't want to give his name, and that was true of many folks in Elk Grove who told me they're apprehensive about these cameras. But people like Chelsea Yoakum, who are comfortable giving their names, were also okay with cameras.
I like the idea of it, personally, because I have a son of my own, you know? You want to reach that one?
No, reach that one.
Okay.
This community has invested hundreds of thousands on surveillance and plans to spend even more. After all, another playground a few blocks from here, one without a camera, was burned to the ground this spring, a suspected arson. Let's head across town to meet the man building the network.
My name is Chris Hill. I'm the IT manager here at the Elk Grove Police Department.
We're walking into the server room that runs the system.
Wow, it's loud in here.
You can get camera feeds, you can make up any screens you want, you can search any video.
More than 100 feeds are viewable and searchable from Chris Hill's desk.
This other one here is actually in a parking lot. This was a known spot in the city of Elk Grove that had a high rate of car burglaries.
So we're watching a woman now open up her minivan door.
Mm-hmm. And then as soon as she drives off, we can follow her out of the parking lot and down the street as well.
Wow, so you can read plates.
Absolutely. So this is probably 100 yards away, and you can very easily read that license plate even as that car is moving.
All these cameras together record more than 4 days of video, each hour. And Hill would like even more.
So we actually have a pilot project coming up, hopefully shortly, with a local retailer that will be giving us access to their parking lot cameras.
But Hill doesn't want his officers spending time watching parking lots, writing down plate numbers. The software can do that for them. And to see how, I traveled to San Francisco and the offices of 3VR.
Most people don't understand that putting more cameras doesn't necessarily yield more information.
Al Shipp is the CEO. His company makes the software Elk Grove uses to sift through its recordings. They offer facial recognition, license plate readers, and object-based searches.
Instead of watching hours and maybe days of video, you can ask questions like, show me all red cars that went east. Those are search arguments you can do with our technology and literally sort through weeks of video in a few seconds.
The software can alert the police when someone enters a park after dark or can search for a face.
Yeah, so this person was captured at 218.
Diego Simkin is a technician at 3VR.
So what I would do is I'd right-click here, search for this person. I have the ability to not only search for this specific camera, but I can search against multiple cameras on that system or multiple systems.
And that kind of ability to expand a video search is a major draw for police in Elk Grove and departments across the country. This industry is growing by 30% a year, and the software alone is poised to become a $1 billion business. In the nation's capital, some are watching with concern.
The idea that all of this information will be fed into one place, I think, is a game changer in terms of how we look at our world.
Laura Donahue is a law professor at Georgetown. She says while it's reasonable to expect that someone will see you lying in a public park,
you do have a reasonable expectation that nobody is going to be following you around 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, everywhere you go.
And Donahue worries that that's where these systems, like the one in Elk Grove, seem to be headed.
That's a camera?
That's a camera, yeah.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah.
Surprising. They should let people know.
Even, Mina Fardon says, if those people are just picnicking in Miwok Park and have nothing to hide.
I'm hiding something.
Not from the camera. The camera's right behind you.
No.
I'm Steve Henn for the NPR Cities Project.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
If you have a smartphone, you might take the internet for granted, right? It's always there. But around the world, some 4.5 billion people still are not connected. Google, being in the internet business, has a plan to expand its reach, bring internet to all these people. But it's not by spooling out fiber optic cable or building cell towers. It's using a technology that, well, sort of sounds like it belongs in another century. Free-floating balloons. They call it Project Loon. They've already launched a pilot system in New Zealand and plan to expand that to the entire 40th parallel south, a ring around the globe. Can it work? How loony is this idea? How do you ensure coverage with a network of thousands of balloons floating through the stratosphere? How do you control these things? Mike Cassidy is the leader of Project Loon, based at Google X. That's Google's secret lab in Mountain View, California. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Cassidy.
Thanks so much.
Balloons, whose idea was it to have balloons?
Well, I mean, Larry Page has talked about using balloons for internets for a while. Mm-hmm. It's an older technology, as you pointed out. Chinese used them quite a while ago to signal from high up. So it's been around for the idea has been around for a while, actually.
Tell me about the pilot program that's running now in New Zealand. How many balloons have you launched? How does it work?
We launched about 30 balloons down in New Zealand, and they're about 20 kilometers up, twice as high as commercial airplanes fly, and they can bring 3G signal from that height all the way down to the ground.
3G signal from how many feet? 30,000? How many
20 feet? 20 kilometers up, wow. More like 70,000 feet, yeah.
70,000, and you can get 3G signals down there. Wow.
Yep.
And it's working.
Yeah, it works great.
Are you expanding the program at all in a larger test?
So the one thing about balloons is they tend to move sort of west to east. So once we put balloons up there, they will float in a ring around the world. And some of the balloons are right now on their way to Chile and Argentina. The goal of the project, once we roll it out further, is to have a continuous ring around the world at 40 degrees south latitude. And anyone under those path of the balloons would be able to use the trial service.
So it's like if I go up in a hot air balloon, I'm sort of... I go where the air currents go. Is that the same thing here?
And that's one of the cool things about the project. We can steer the balloons by increasing or decreasing the altitude of the balloon and finding a wind that's going the direction we want. So if we see we want to go a little bit further north, we perhaps drop down a half a kilometer, find a wind going that direction, and then stop at that altitude, and that's the way we steer the balloons.
And how long can they stay up?
We're hoping the balloons will stay up for 100 days. This design has lasted 58 days previously, so we need to make a few improvements to get to that 100-day duration.
Now, we talked to Terry Hoke, who is a senior engineer at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and he has a lot of experience launching these sort of balloons. And he said, let me quote him, "It's very feasible to launch them and have them navigate the globe. In terms of trying to control them, steering the balloon by changing altitude is incredibly difficult to do. I wouldn't have a whole lot of faith in that part of it." Would you say that there are significant challenges in that?
There's definitely challenges. It requires a pretty sophisticated computational algorithm to say, okay, balloon number one is now moving 10 miles an hour east over a certain spot. Balloon number two, in order to take its place, it's moving slightly southeast. Balloon number three, which is going to take that one's place, is at 14 miles an hour, moving a slightly different direction. But that's one of the things that Google has experience with, building a sort of large simulation, large computational ability, and be able to program these thousands of balloons to go to the right place at the right time.
And where is that right place?
Well, for the pilot test, for example, if we want to have a continuous ring, we don't actually have to have them uniformly distributed around the globe. Mm-hmm. For example, we don't need the same density over the middle of the Pacific Ocean as we do over Christchurch itself. But by steering them and planning, you can have them appear in the right density in the sky over the places that need coverage.
Mm-hmm. And where is it? Those are undercovered places around the globe. Where are the prime places for that?
There's lots of places. In the Southern Hemisphere alone, two-thirds of the countries, the cost of internet access is higher than the average monthly income for people in those countries. Even in China and India, there's over 1 billion people that don't have good internet coverage. So I think there's lots of places around the world where there's sort of remote and rural areas that don't have coverage or it's unaffordable.
So would you have to keep relaunching new balloons as these go down just to keep that ring going?
Yes, every 100 days you'd have to put up another balloon to take the place of the one that came down.
Mm-hmm. Now, at those altitudes, aren't we talking about extremely cold temperatures, like minus 70 below Fahrenheit up there?
It's a tough environment. In the daytime, it's typically minus 40 Celsius, and at night, it's minus 60 Celsius. It's also very low atmospheric density, only about 2 or 3% of the density of the air up there that it is down here, so it's closer to a space environment. It's also a high ultraviolet environment. The sun beats down really hard on our balloons, so it is a tough environment to live in.
Why is this better than just putting a satellite up and doing it that way?
So we don't think our solution or anyone's solution is the only solution. We think there are different approaches. One of the interesting things about our approach is we can continuously update our service every 100 days with communication satellites. And I'm an aerospace engineer. I used to build communication satellites. It often takes quite a while, a number of years, to build the satellites. Can be quite expensive, hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's also on the order of $100 million to put the satellite up. And then the satellites sometimes will have a life of 10 years or so. And that's great, except that also means the technology it's not easy to get the latest technology up into the satellite.
Mm-hmm. So you can, by launching a new balloon every 100 days, you can upgrade the hardware too by doing that.
That's right. You get the latest state-of-the-art technology every 100 days.
And what is give us an idea of the costs involved here. What is a balloon and its package cost to get up there?
So this is very early in this stage of the sort of pilot test. We're building these things by hand now. But the exciting thing is the envelope for the balloon is made out of polyethylene plastic, so it's not a very exotic plastic. And the electronical components are mostly off-the-shelf. I mean, an off-the-shelf type battery, an electronics, GPS module. So we're hopeful that by using low-cost parts, off-the-shelf type technology, we can make the system low cost and therefore very affordable for people when we roll out the service.
Mm-hmm. And when would that be rolled out?
Well, again, it's sort of early days. We've just launched last Saturday this sort of small pilot test. So it's really hard to predict how long it will take to expand, let alone to other areas in New Zealand and other areas around the 40th degree latitude, let alone sort of moving to other areas. Mm-hmm. But we hope soon.
Mm-hmm. And 40-degree latitude, would that be like where New Zealand is in the southern Pacific and head out there?
That's right. That's right. And that was one of the reasons we thought it would be a good place to do our pilot test, because it was an easy number of countries to do the test in, four countries, New Zealand, Australia, Chile, and Argentina, would be sort of flown over by the balloons. So it made it a more manageable size.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you're right off the balloon when it comes down, right? No one's going to retrieve it. It might come down in the ocean.
No, we plan to retrieve. We hope to retrieve all the balloons. We have a very high retention recovery rate right now. We can control where the balloons come down. So as they become near the end of their life, we open up a little valve at the top and bring the balloon down to a recovery area. We had a boat off the coast of New Zealand. For some of the test balloons, when we're done with the test, we brought them down the ocean and recover them. But yes, we plan to recover almost all the balloons if we can.
Mm-hmm. And how many total number of balloons do you envision in a ring at any one time?
For a ring around the 40th degree south latitude, we think it will take about 300 balloons, spacing them out depending upon whether the coverage density is required. And obviously, to expand beyond that ring of 40 degrees south latitude will take, thousands of balloons to go more than that.
Sounds exciting. We wish you luck, Mike.
Thanks so much for having us on today.
You're welcome. Mike Cassidy, leader of Project Loon, that's based at Google X. He was joining us by phone to talk about that.
This is Fresh Air. One effect of the revelations about NSA surveillance has been to bring the unfamiliar word metadata into the spotlight. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, explains what metadata is, how it's related to the big data revolution, and whether it makes any difference. Or, as he puts it, does meta matter?
This is just metadata. There's no content involved. That was how Senator Dianne Feinstein defended the NSA's blanket surveillance of Americans' phone records and internet activity. Before those revelations, not many people had heard of metadata, the term librarians and programmers use for the data that describes a particular document or record it's linked to. It's the data you find on a card in a library catalog, or the creation date and size of a file in a folder window. It's the penciled note on the back of a snapshot, Kathleen and Ashley, Lake Charles, 1963. Or it could be the times, numbers, and GPS locations attached to the calls in a phone log. Metadata was bound to break out sooner or later, riding the wave of data in all its forms and combinations. Big data and data mining are the reigning tech buzzwords these days, and university faculties are scrambling to meet the surge in demand for courses in the hot new field of data science. It's as if data is usurping information as a byword. Up to now, data has played a supporting role in the information age. There's a popular definition of data as the raw material that becomes information when it's processed and made meaningful. That puts information at the center of the modern tech world. But it isn't how anybody actually uses the two words. I have this image of somebody working on a spreadsheet as a manager leans over and says, "Is it information yet?" But the shift in focus from information to data reflects a genuine difference between the two. Information brings to mind the knowledge that's gathered in libraries, encyclopedias, and journals, stuff that has an independent existence in the world. Data is always connected to particular things and events. It comes from experiments and sensors and official records, or from the scuff marks we leave behind as we click on websites, make calls, go through the EasyPass toll booth, visit an ATM. It's all out there, accumulating in ginorma bytes, overflowing the server farms. When you're focused on information in that standalone sense, metadata plays a subordinate role. In the old days, it was just a tool for getting to the stuff you were really interested in. Think how much metadata you had to wade through to find a passage about drunkenness in Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Looking up the book in the library card catalog, writing down its call number, finding it on the shelves, searching for drunkenness in the index, then finally turning to the page. Now that that kind of information's online, metadata can seem almost irrelevant. No need for catalogs or indexes. You just enter a query, and when the book comes up, you barrel in sideways. That's probably why Google was so careless about metadata when they digitized major library collections for Google Books. Literally millions of books are misdated or misclassified. It's not odd to run into a web browser manual dated 1939 that lists Sigmund Freud as its author, or a copy of Madame Bovary attributed to Henry James and filed under Antiques and Collectibles. The faulty metadata prompted some grumbles from academics, and Google's been working on fixing it. But it doesn't bother most of the people who use Google Books. They get at its information in other ways. But metadata gets a lot more respect in other corners of the Google campus, not to mention from its competitors up and down US 101. Their focus isn't on information in the abstract, but on collecting specific data about their users. And for that, they need to get the metadata right. Who's visited this page? How long did they stay? Where did they go next? Who did they email, call, or text? All so that advertisers can ensure that the seersucker jacket I clicked on yesterday will stalk me to the end of my days. That's the same kind of metadata the NSA has been trawling. Its defenders maintain that we have to be willing to trade some privacy for security, and right now we're all arguing about where to put the boundaries. But some advocates of the surveillance have also tried to soft-pedal its intrusiveness. You hear people pronouncing metadata as a soothing incantation, as if your right to privacy ends as soon as you lick and seal the envelope. Sifting through the metadata, the president said, involves just modest encroachments on privacy. James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, compared the programs to combing through a library with millions of volumes and sorting them by their Dewey Decimal numbers without actually opening and reading the books. But if you're going to compare this to rummaging around in an old-fashioned library, it's more like opening the back covers of all the books to see whose names are on the borrower's cards. Whether or not you think the government should be sweeping this stuff up, calling it metadata doesn't make the process any less intrusive. Tell me where you've been and who you've been talking to, and I'll tell you about your politics, your health, your sexual orientation, your finances. So maybe we should just let the word sink back into the nerdy cubicles it came from. When it comes to privacy, the meta doesn't matter. In the post-information age, it's just data all the way down.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Yeezus, the new album from Kanye West. This is Fresh Air.